The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance, that's GSUGGSinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's issue of Time Magazine is the one that I read from last week. It is dated February 15/February 22, 2021. The cover is bordered as usual in the bright red with a black background on the cover. Superimposed upon that are the gray large block letters, Time. The cover photo features Amanda Gorman in a voluminous yellow gown, the portrait provided by AFP Getty Images. Beginning with the first article, which is short, it's in reference to the YMCA, and there's a photograph here of a smiling man, a person of color. He has grayish hair and mustache. Here on the top of his head, as well as his mustache. He is smiling. He's wearing, from what we can see of this headshot, a pinstripe suit, light-colored shirt, and light-colored print tie. It's Kevin Washington, first black president and CEO of YMCA of the USA. Born into slavery, Anthony Bowen, B-O-W-E-N, purchased his freedom and went on to become the first black clerk in the U.S. Patent Office. Bowen first heard of the YMCA from a white co-worker who was associated with the YMCA in Washington, D.C. But this was the early 1850s, and even as a free black man, Bowen was barred from membership in many organizations, including the YMCA. Bowen decided that a black YMCA was needed, so he founded it in 1853. In 2015, I, and the I being Kevin Washington, have the honor of becoming the first black president and CEO of YMCA of the USA, which supports and leads over 2,600 Ys across the country, serving more than 21 million people of every race, ethnicity, and creed. I stand on the shoulders of pioneers like Anthony Bowen, who had the determination and bravery to demand belonging in a society that excluded them. The history of the YMCA, like the history of America, is a story of incremental progress toward greater inclusion and equity for all. At the Y, we've been on this journey for nearly 170 years, and we still have a long way to go. We envision a society of inclusive communities where everyone feels that they truly belong and can access the support they need to reach their fullest potential with dignity. Join us on this journey. Get involved with your local Y today, www.ymca.net. And again, that was written by Kevin Washington, President and CEO, YMCA of the USA. The next article, under Nation, workers on the line, deemed essential, some turn to unions for protection from COVID-19. This is by Abigail Abrams. It does show a 1.5-page color photograph of about half a dozen people standing in a slightly disorganized group, but they're all holding large signs. One says, "Safe staffing saves lives," and it has a heart, a red heart on a blue background. Another is black lettering on a red background, "Save Lives." Red lettering on a white background, "Patients over Profits." Blue lettering on a white background, "Nurses need 15-minute breaks." I should hope so. In the background, another sign that said, this is black on white, Nurses United. And another sign by one of the people in the front row, whose face is obscured by the sign, red lettering on white, Safe Staffing Saves Lives. The people whose faces are seen in the photograph, because some are holding signs in front of their faces, are all wearing masks. And the caption reads, Medical Professionals Picket at Los Robles Regional Medical Center in Thousand Oaks, California, November 30. The photograph is by Al Seib, S-E-I-B. Saru, C-E-R-U-E, Cotton, never expected to find herself on a picket line as a forklift operator for Cash Wah, a regional food distributor in Fargo, North Dakota. She enjoyed the physical challenges and responsibility of her job and was used to working overnight hours. Then COVID-19 arrived. The coronavirus, which had seemed like a faraway problem last spring and summer, began spiking in her community in September. Cotton had a newborn baby and two older children at home, both of whom have asthma. She no longer felt safe going to work. For months, Cash Wah, and that is spelled C-A-S-H-W-A, had failed to require masks in its warehouses, enforce social distancing rules, or screen employees. The company's only precaution, she says, were handing out cloth masks and placing two bottles of hand sanitizer in the break room. By late November, Cotton and her fellow workers, all deemed essential under guidance from the federal government, had reached a breaking point. They banded together and refused to work for 24 hours. I was super nervous because it was my very first time doing a strike, Cotton says. The American labor movement is having a moment as the federal government designated millions of Americans as essential workers during the deadly pandemic. People like Cotton, who've never gone on strike or considered themselves activists, have been moved to organize protests, sick outs, and strikes. Grocery stores, warehouses, hospitals, nursing homes, restaurants, schools, and health clinics all saw walkouts last year. Now labor organizers and union leaders hope the spotlight that COVID-19 has put on workers' rights will give the struggling labor movement a new and perhaps lasting momentum. Anytime workers participate in collective action and succeed, they learn a lifelong lesson, says Rebecca Given, a professor of labor studies and employment relations at Rutgers. Motivating workers to organize is a grim reality. With certain exceptions, such as doctors and nurses, those deemed essential during the pandemic tend to be the workers valued least of all, earning relatively low wages and lacking access to employer benefits like paid sick leave or hazard pay. While the shortage of personal protective equipment, PPE, eased at larger hospitals by the end of 2020, many essential workers, not directly in the medical field, still struggle to consistently access masks or face shields. The new wave of worker interest has not reversed organized labor's long dwindling numbers. Overall, union membership continued its decades-long decline as the pandemic swept the country. In 2020, the total number of workers in unions across the U.S. dropped by 321,000 to reach a low of 14.3 million as national employment fell and companies pressed legal advantages to deter employees from organizing. But help may be on the way. After 4 years of employer-friendly decisions under Donald Trump, the Biden administration has reset the tone in a flurry of moves hailed by labor. President Joe Biden picked Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, a former union leader, as his labor secretary, and fired the Trump-appointed general counsel of the National Labor Relations Board, NLRB, the agency tasked with enforcing private sector labor laws, and his deputy within his first 2 days in the White House. Biden signed executive orders aimed at increasing collective bargaining rights, minimum wages, and protections, and called on the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, to issue new guidance on protecting employees from the pandemic, a step the agency quickly took January 29. There is a lot of work to do. Until now, the federal government has, for the most part, declined to erect any safeguards for the workers it says should keep working during the pandemic. While Congress included paid sick leave in its first coronavirus relief package last spring, large loopholes left millions of essential workers ineligible. Lawmakers passed no federal hazard pay requirements. The Trump administration's NLRB rolled back and weakened worker protections, while OSHA was criticized for its lax treatment of worker complaints in 2020. They are being forced to go out there, says Kim Cordova, president of the United Food and Commercial Workers Local 7, which represents 25,000 workers in Colorado and Wyoming. But nobody's protecting them. Meanwhile, many essential workers' employers, including Walmart, Amazon, Kroger, and Costco, have raked in record profits. The Brookings Institution found that 13 of the largest retail companies in the country earned a total of $16.7 billion more in 2020 than they did in 2019, while raising workers' pay an average of just $1.11 per hour since the start of the pandemic. The billionaires have gotten much, much richer over the course of the pandemic, and workers are still struggling, says Given. All of those factors coming together has created a moment with a lot of potential. The choice to strike is never easy, but giving up a paycheck and benefits during a global pandemic when hundreds of thousands of businesses are shuttering and tens of millions of workers are being laid off is a huge risk, especially when the work you are leaving is deemed vital. In March, when COVID-19 cases were first rising, Tanya Basil, an infectious disease nurse at Albany Medical Center in New York, put off talk of a strike, and so did her coworkers. The nurses were like, "This is a serious time. We're needed. We can't be striking," she recalls. But by November, after months of workers sharing ill-fitting and sometimes dirty PPE and raising concerns about other infection control failures at the hospital, Basil's union filed an OSHA complaint and voted to strike. Not only our hospital, but the CDC and everyone around us were decreasing the standards so that we could work in these horrible conditions, she says. When workers do choose to strike, it tends to have an add-on effect, labor experts say. Over the past year, unionized workers across the country say they've seen an increase in outreach from non-members interested in joining their ranks. Joe Crane, a representative for the Union of American Physicians and Dentists, says that during the first month of the pandemic alone, his union heard from as many doctors reaching out to learn about organizing as it does in a typical year. In Albany, Basil also saw a surge in union membership among nurses who did not previously think the union was necessary. A lot of them are with us right now, she says. Matthew Carey, a physician assistant in Lacey, Washington, did not know his union existed when he took the job at the Multicare Indigo Urgent Care Clinics, and he was not excited about joining. But in 2020, after Multicare management repeatedly refused to provide N95 masks or address providers' other concerns, Carey stood on the strike line with his colleagues. For Carey, the decision was driven not only by concerns about his own safety, but the safety of his community, a sentiment dozens of workers and labor activists expressed. if drivers come in contact with somebody in the warehouse who's infected, and they take this back out to their customer, that affects our community, says Brian Nowak, who works for the union representing the 75 Kashwa workers who went on strike in North Dakota. This could, in essence, become a hub for the coronavirus. His point is borne out in research. In September, Adam Dean, a professor of political science at George Washington University, co-authored a study in health affairs showing unionized nursing homes were associated with a 30% lower mortality rate at the height of the first coronavirus surge compared with nursing homes without unions. The unions were also associated with greater access to PPE and a lower COVID-19 infection rate. Labor unions provide protections that not only benefit workers in the union, but have broader benefits for society, Dean says. In some places, organizing during COVID-19 has paid off for workers. In West Virginia, Kroger employees' strike threat earned them raises and limits on health care premium increases. When the MultiCare Indigo providers in Washington went on strike in November, the company ignored their demands for weeks, but after finding itself under scrutiny, it reversed course and started rolling out N95s to urgent care providers December 14. Yet in much of the country, labor activists say progress has been sluggish. The patchwork system of coronavirus-inspired relief, combined with the government's lax enforcement of workers' right to organize, has weakened what might have been more robust national momentum, says Dean. Even if there's an increase in individual interest to join unions, there's still major obstacles in American labor law that make it difficult for workers to actually form or join a union, he says. Labor organizers are hopeful that even incremental progress portends a changing landscape. In February 2020, the House passed legislation that would make it easier for workers to organize, limit employers' anti-union tools, and increase penalties for companies that interfere. Biden supports that bill, and his host of other actions could start making a difference soon. And if workers did not win every fight in 2020, Rutgers Given says even unsuccessful attempts at organizing can have a lasting impact. By starting to understand the big picture and how hard they are working and where the profits are going, they're more likely to engage in fighting for fairness in the future, Given says. When Cotton, the forklift driver, returned to work after the November strike, nothing much had changed. The only difference, she says, was a box of disposable gloves by the kitchen sink and a prickly attitude from her supervisor. But she does not regret joining the picket line. It was important to show the company that she and her coworkers know they deserve to be treated fairly. I knew what I did was the right thing, she says. From the View Science, How Dreams Defend Our Brains, by David Eagleman and Don Vaughn. Eagleman is a neuroscientist at Stanford and the author of Live Wired. Vaughn is a neuroscientist at UCLA. When he was 2 years old, Ben stopped seeing out of his left eye. His mother took him to the doctor and soon discovered he had retinal cancer in both eyes. After chemotherapy and radiation failed, surgeons removed both his eyes. For Ben, vision was gone forever. By the time he was 7 years old, he had devised a technique for decoding the world around him. He clicked with his mouth and listened for the returning echoes. This method enabled Ben to determine the locations of open doorways, people, parked cars, garbage cans, and so on. He was echolocating, bouncing his sound waves off objects in the environment and catching the reflections to build a mental model of his surroundings. Echolocation may sound like an improbable feat for a human, but thousands of blind people have perfected this skill just as Ben did. How could blindness give rise to the stunning ability to understand the surroundings with one's ears? The answer lies in a gift bestowed on the brain by evolution, tremendous adaptability. Whenever we learn something, pick up a new skill, or modify our habits, the physical structure of our brain changes. Neurons, the cells responsible for rapidly processing information in the brain, are interconnected by the thousands. But like friendships in a community, the connections between them constantly change, strengthening, weakening, and finding new partners. Neuroscience calls this phenomenon brain plasticity, referring to the ability of the brain, like plastic, to assume new shapes and hold them. More recent discoveries in neuroscience, though, suggest the brain's brand of flexibility is far more nuanced than holding on to a shape. To capture this, we refer to the brain's plasticity as live wiring. To spotlight how this vast system of 86 billion neurons and 0.2 quadrillion connections rewires itself every moment of your life. The brain's live wiring allows for learning, memory, and the ability to develop new skills. Recent decades have yielded several revelations about live wiring, but perhaps the biggest surprise is its rapidity. Brain circuits reorganize not only in the newly blind, but also in the sighted who have temporary blindness. In one study, sighted participants intensively learned how to read Braille. Half the participants were blindfolded throughout the experience. At the end of 5 days, the participants who wore blindfolds could distinguish subtle differences between Braille characters much better than the participants who did not wear blindfolds. Even more remarkably, the blindfolded participants showed activation in visual brain regions in response to touch and sound. In other words, the blindfolded participants performed better on the touch-related task because their visual cortex had been recruited to help. But such changes do not have to take 5 days. That just happened to be when the measurement took place. When blindfolded participants are continuously measured, touch-related activity shows up in the visual cortex in about an hour. What do brain flexibility and rapid cortical takeover have to do with dreaming? Perhaps more than previously thought, Ben clearly benefited from the redistribution of his visual cortex to other senses because he had permanently lost his eyes. But what about the participants in the blindfold experiments? If our loss of a sense is only temporary, then the rapid conquest of brain territory may not be so helpful. And this, we propose, is why we dream. In the ceaseless competition for brain territory, the visual system has a unique problem. Because of the planet's rotation, all animals are cast into darkness for an average of 12 out of every 24 hours. Our ancestors effectively were unwitting participants in the blindfold experiment every night of their lives. So how did the visual cortex of our ancestors' brains defend its territory in the absence of input from the eyes? We suggest the brain preserves the territory of the visual cortex by keeping it active at night. In our defensive activation theory, dream sleep exists to keep neurons in the visual cortex active, thereby combating a takeover by the neighboring senses. In this view, dreams are primarily visual precisely because this is the only sense that is disadvantaged by darkness. Thus, only the visual cortex is vulnerable in a way that warrants internally generated activity to preserve its territory. In humans, sleep is punctuated by rapid eye movement, REM sleep, every 90 minutes. This is when most dreaming occurs. REM sleep is triggered by a specialized set of neurons that pump activity straight into the brain's visual cortex, causing us to experience vision even though our eyes are closed. This activity in the visual cortex is presumably why dreams are pictorial and filmic. The anatomical precision of these circuits suggests that dream sleep is biologically important. Such precise and universal circuitry rarely evolves without an important function behind it. The defensive activation theory makes some clear predictions about dreaming. For example, because brain flexibility diminishes with age, the fraction of sleep spent in REM should also decrease across the lifespan. And that is exactly what happens. In humans, REM accounts for half of an infant's sleep time, but the percentage decreases steadily to about 18% in the elderly. REM sleep appears to become less necessary as the brain becomes less flexible. Of course, this relationship is not sufficient to prove the defensive activation theory. To test it on a deeper level, we broadened our investigation to animals other than humans. The defensive activation theory makes a specific prediction. The more flexible an animal's brain, the more REM sleep it should have to defend its visual system during sleep. To this end, we examined the extent to which the brains of 25 species of primates are pre-programmed versus flexible at birth. We looked at the time it takes animals of each species to develop. How long do they take to wean from their mothers? How quickly do they learn to walk? How many years until they reach adolescence? The more rapid an animal's development, the more pre-programmed, less flexible, the brain. As predicted, we found species with more flexible brains spend more time in REM sleep each night. Although these two measures, brain flexibility and REM sleep, would seem at first to be unrelated, they are in fact linked. Dream circuitry is so fundamentally important that it is found even in people who are born blind. However, those who are born blind or who become blind early in life do not experience visual imagery in their dreams. Instead, they have other sensory experiences, such as feeling their way around a rearranged living room or hearing strange dogs barking. This is because other senses have taken over their visual cortex. In other words, blind and sighted people alike experience activity in the same region of their brain during dreams. They differ only in the senses that are processed there. We developed our defensive activation theory to explain visual hallucinations during extended periods of darkness, but it may represent a more general principle. The brain has evolved specific circuitry to generate activity that compensates for periods of deprivation. This might occur in several scenarios when deprivation is regular and predictable, that is, dreams during sleep, when there's damage to the sensory input pathway, that is, tinnitus or phantom limb syndrome, and when deprivation is unpredictable, that is, hallucinations induced by sensory deprivation. Hallucinations during deprivation may, in fact, be a feature of the system. Dreams have long perplexed philosophers, priests, and poets. We suggest that dream sleep exists, at least in part, to prevent the other senses from taking over the brain's visual cortex when it goes unused. Dreams are the counterbalance against too much flexibility. Dreams may be better understood as the strange love child of brain plasticity and the rotation of the planet. This is the view, underscored with world, Putin's Nemesis by Michael D. Weiss. It was minus 61 Fahrenheit in Yakutsk, about 300 miles south of the Arctic Circle, January 23, but the people still came. The scene was something out of a post-apocalyptic movie, a queue of dimly visible figures against the whited-out backdrop of a snow squall. They had come to show solidarity with Alexei Navalny. That's N-A-V-A-L-N-Y. Navalny, the detained leader of the Russian opposition, was arrested upon his return from Germany, where he'd been recovering from an attempt on his life by Russian intelligence agents. He had called on social media for nationwide protests. They were on rooftops in Vladivostok. Protesters thronged the city squares of Novosibirsk and Irkutsk, where they chanted, "We will not leave." Authorities roughed them up, even the kids in Moscow, where as many as 40,000 turned out, some to chant the common refrain, "Putin is a thief." Despite the dragnet of arrests and state harassment, the protesters were unbowed and returned to the streets across Russia a week later, January 31, all on behalf of one man. To the Kremlin, officially, Navalny is a non-entity, a convicted fraudster, a dangerous CIA agent sent to foment regime change, or all of the above. To Westerners, he's the dissident who survived a state assassination plot, then helped solve his own attempted murder. To millions of Russians, he's the country's most famous and persistent gadfly, the vivisectionist of its crooked ruling class. The videos his anti-corruption foundation put out mix satire, pop culture, and zippy animation with a connect-the-dots forensic approach to exposing the corruption among oligarchs, ministers, and law enforcement officials who are not exactly hiding their ill-gotten gains when they show up in public with wristwatches worth many times their annual salaries. If there's a theme to Navalny's oeuvre, it is that Russia's modern kleptocracy is the offspring of an unholy matrimony of former mid-level KGB officers and a post-Soviet nomenclatura of bandits in business suits. The obvious question, then, was why Navalny chose to go back to Russia after proving just how much his enemies want him dead. He has repeatedly ruled out becoming another exile of Putin's regime because, as he explains, that would be its most sought-after outcome after his physical elimination. It is easy to ridicule and dismiss a Kremlin opponent hurling invective from abroad, but much more difficult to do so when he does so from within the lion's den. By returning to Moscow, he conducted his own qualitative plebiscite. How much power does he really wield if tens of thousands across Russia are willing to defy truncheons, cages, and below-freezing temperatures to set him free? For one thing, Navalny, who was sentenced February 2 to more than 2.5 years in a penal colony, has put Putin in an obvious bind. Killing him now means creating a martyr and precipitating even more domestic unrest, not to mention incurring increased Western sanctions at a time when a new White House has shown a far greater willingness to confront Moscow. Older ralliers in the protests said they hadn't taken to the streets since the collapse of the Soviet Union. By one estimate, 42% of those who turned out are newcomers to political activism. Navalny's suffering, combined with his relentless exposure of corruption, something Putin's own lieutenants have described as a pathology eating away at the nation, have won him admirers in the unlikeliest precincts. A large segment of Navalny's online fan base consists of those who were born after Putin became president in 2000. None of this means Putin's reign is in immediate jeopardy. It just means it has found its most effective opponent. Unlike so many other dissidents in recent years, Navalny is untainted by any past entanglement with the system he now opposes. He never served in the Russian government, nor made a fortune by enabling, only to later repudiate his former masters out of principle or opportunism or both, and he speaks in a 21st century, digitally savvy language, mordant, ironic, and thoroughly unimpressed by authority. More important, he gets results. At a virtual meeting with Russian university students, Putin was asked about his $1.5 billion Black Sea pleasure dome, which was exposed by Navalny's investigations. Although he could not bring himself to utter Navalny's name, he never does, he disclaimed ownership of the palace. So now the dictator is answering his prisoners' questions. Michael D. Weiss, who wrote this article, is writing a history of Russian military intelligence. Here are three short paragraph items entitled Short Reads, Not Enough. Zucked, Z-U-K-E-D, author, Roger McNamee, and Rappler CEO and executive editor Maria Ressa are critical of Facebook's plan for determining if Donald Trump is permanently banned. We should not pretend that the Facebook Oversight Board is more than a MacGuffin designed to distract us from serious issues. Fixing what is broken. Women have lost a disproportionate number of the jobs taken by COVID-19, but the system was not working for them long before the pandemic, writes NBC Universal Vice Chairman Bonnie Hammer. To get women and our economy back to work, we have to change our culture. Ongoing support. A one-time $2,000 stimulus check is not enough to help American families, writes Natalie Foster, co-founder and co-chair of the Economic Security Project, who argues that the government should target recurring checks to people who need them most and who will spend them to spur the economy. It is good economics and the moral thing to do, she writes. Health. This is what the future looks like. We may never eliminate COVID-19, but we can learn to live with it. By Jamie Ducharme. When does a pandemic end? Is it when life regains a semblance of normality? Is it when the world reaches herd immunity, the benchmark at which people are immune to an infectious disease to stop its widespread circulation? Or is it when the disease is defeated, the last patient cured, and the pathogen retired to the history books? The last scenario in the case of COVID-19 is likely a ways off, if it ever arrives. The virus has infected more than 100 million people worldwide and killed more than 2 million. New viral variants, even more contagious than those that started the pandemic, are spreading across the world. And though highly effective vaccines were developed and deployed in record time, it will be a mammoth undertaking to inoculate enough of the world's population to achieve herd immunity, especially with the new variants in hot pursuit. Already in many countries with access to vaccines, logistical hurdles and vaccine hesitancy have proved to be formidable adversaries. Meanwhile, many nations in the developing world do not have access to vaccines at all. There have been and will continue to be global success stories. Israel has vaccinated a significant chunk of its population, enough to begin feasibly planning for a post-herd immunity reality. New Zealand has effectively eliminated COVID-19 through a combination of domestic lockdowns and border control measures, and Australia and multiple Asian countries have used similar tactics to dramatically tamp down the virus's spread. But in places like the U.S., where the virus continues to spread widely, elimination is at this point a far less attainable goal than management. In the U.S., as in many parts of the world, experts say COVID-19 is likely, at least for the foreseeable future, to become endemic, a disease that circulates regularly, if not as catastrophically as it has over the past year. That does not mean it will be everywhere, all the time, but it may not disappear completely either. Our challenge in the U.S., then, may not be vanquishing the virus that has dominated the past year of our lives. It may be learning to live with it. Imagine today's date is September 1, 2021. You have received both of your vaccine doses. Your neighbors have been fully vaccinated, too, so you are having them over for dinner tonight. COVID-19 cases have become rare in your town. You will wear a mask when you go out to pick up groceries just to be safe, and there are still signs up at the pharmacy counter advertising COVID-19 vaccination. For the most part, though, life feels pretty normal. Your brother, who lives a few states away, is living in a different reality. Several clusters of cases related to a new viral variant have emerged in his area, prompting schools to delay their start dates. Masks are required in public, and restaurants are asking patrons to leave their information in case they need to start contact tracing. The health department is setting up public testing and vaccination sites, and health officials are on the news each night encouraging unvaccinated people to get their shots. You were planning to visit your brother for Thanksgiving, but you may scrap those plans if things get much worse in his area. That is a hypothetical scenario. Of course, COVID-19 is a new disease, and there's no roadmap for predicting its future. No one knows how long it will take the U.S. to reach herd immunity, or whether we will get there at all. If the virus mutates faster than vaccines can be administered, or if a significant share of the population opts not to get vaccinated, the window may slam shut. Scientists do not know how many people need to get vaccinated to reach that threshold, even if everything goes well, though recent estimates put the figure at well above 70% of the population. That is a daunting goal, since only about 8% of people in the U.S. have been vaccinated so far. What does seem safe to say is that COVID-19 will become increasingly manageable as more people get vaccinated, slowing, if not stopping, the virus's spread through communities. Despite the sluggish start to vaccine distribution in the U.S., if we vaccinate efficiently in April, May, June, July, August, we should have that degree of protection that could get us back to some form of normality by fall. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, said in January. Even assuming the U.S. picks up the pace on vaccinations, there will still be gaps in protection. The two COVID-19 vaccines currently authorized in the U.S., made by Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna, are both about 95% effective at preventing disease. But there's a small subset of people for whom they will not work. It is also unclear whether being vaccinated means you cannot transmit the virus to others. And there will always be people who choose not to or are unable to get vaccinated. Plus, children younger than 16 are not currently eligible for vaccination, which means the virus may keep spreading among young people until vaccine makers complete studies on children, hopefully sometime this year. All that means the U.S. is unlikely to eliminate COVID-19 in the near future, says Saskia Popescu, an assistant professor of biodefense at George Mason University. A country like New Zealand, an island nation with about 5 million residents, will have an easier time stamping out a virus than a global travel hub with 330 million citizens living across more than 50 states and territories. But even if elimination is far off, I think we will enter a phase of low-level prevalence, says Dr. Sandro Galea, Dean of the Boston University School of Public Health. Yes, there will be a disease among us, but there are many diseases among us. Some current precautions, like wearing masks in public, will likely remain widespread throughout 2021, while more drastic measures like school closures or stay-at-home orders will hopefully become temporary and targeted based on where case clusters emerge. If case counts in an area begin to tick upward, public health departments should be ready to respond quickly with vaccination and testing campaigns, Popescu says. Viral variants only complicate the equation. It is standard for viruses to mutate the longer they spread. As more people gain immunity to a virus, it adapts to the changing conditions, sometimes becoming more contagious or even more virulent. In the process, already more infectious variants of SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, have begun to spread around the world. Research suggests currently authorized vaccines will work against them, but there's always the frightening possibility that the virus will mutate enough that that's no longer true. Jonna Mazet, a professor of epidemiology and disease ecology at the University of California, Davis, says the U.S. will need to set up a robust surveillance system to watch for new variants of the virus. That might mean future international travelers will also have to get tested upon arrival in the U.S., or that large employers and hospitals will have to regularly test their employees or patients to watch for new variants emerging in the population. To enable this kind of surveillance, the World Health Organization, WHO, is working with countries around the world to strengthen their genetic sequencing abilities. Maria van Kerkhove, the WHO's technical lead on COVID-19, says that may mean leveraging labs already set up to detect the flu, HIV, tuberculosis, and other diseases, and setting guidelines for which samples need genetic sequencing, prioritizing, for example, those that come from unusual case clusters or from patients with abnormal symptoms. If concerning mutations do pop up, vaccine makers may have to tweak their shots and offer new versions as boosters. Luckily, the mRNA technology used to develop both Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna's shots enables them to make this kind of adjustment in weeks. The shots use the virus's genetic sequence to teach the body how to make proteins that trigger an immune response. So scientists could just sub in the new genetic information where relevant. Van Kerkhove says it's possible vaccines will be tailor-made for certain geographical regions depending on how and where the virus mutates. But global travel means new strains will not stay contained for long. That underscores wealthy countries' responsibility to help developing nations get access to vaccines, Mazet says, for the benefit of the people who live there, of course, but also for the rest of the world. Even if one country achieves herd immunity, that status could be threatened by new viral mutations emerging from areas without broad vaccine coverage. The good news is we already know how to live with viruses like seasonal influenza and the coronaviruses that cause the common cold. These diseases are not harmless. The flu infects millions of people in the U.S. each year and kills tens of thousands, but we have learned to minimize their damage. Flu shots are neither perfectly protective nor universally used, but the U.S. has honed the art of administering them. Each year, pharmacies, medical offices, workplaces, and public clinics vaccinate millions of people, often for free. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention also has a surveillance system designed to track where and how widely influenza strains are circulating. Research that occasionally leads to targeted precautions like temporary school closures. People also know to take extra disease prevention precautions during flu season. COVID-19 prevention may ultimately look similar. It is possible that COVID-19 vaccines will need to be administered yearly, like flu shots. A surveillance network will also be necessary to watch for new variants or areas where case counts are creeping upward. But if countries stay vigilant about precautions like masking, and if coronavirus vaccines turn out to be fairly long-lasting and almost universally used, our approach to COVID-19 may someday mirror that of nearly eliminated diseases like measles. The measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine is required for most school children, and its protection usually lasts a lifetime. About 85% of the world's children have had at least one dose of the measles vaccine. In the U.S., about 92% of adolescents have received both recommended shots. That's an aspirational target when designing COVID-19 vaccination campaigns. Still, measles outbreaks do occasionally occur in the U.S., particularly among children who live in communities with high levels of vaccine skepticism. But because measles vaccination is so widespread and effective, such incidents are rare. Even in 2019, one of the worst years for measles in recent history, only about 1,300 people in the U.S. got sick. It may never be possible to drive COVID-19 case counts down that low, especially since immunity from COVID-19, unlike measles, may not be lifelong. But Ralph Baric, B-A-R-I-C, a coronavirus researcher at the University of North Carolina, says he can envision a future in which, thanks to widespread vaccination, COVID-19 also becomes primarily a disease of childhood, and probably a mild one at that. Kids rarely develop severe cases of COVID-19, and such cases may become increasingly rare with time. As with other coronaviruses, children may be exposed to SARS-CoV-2 early in life and progressively build up immunity to it, taking it from a fearsome pathogen to a routine part of life. Of course, Baric cautions, predictions can be wrong. Containing the virus is difficult enough from a scientific and logistical perspective, but recovering from a pandemic also raises a number of ethical issues. What would the world look like, for example, if eligibility to work, socialize, and generally live a public life were contingent on vaccination status? About 50% of executives said in a recent poll they plan to require non-remote employees to get vaccinated, and vaccine mandatory weddings and parties will almost certainly pop up on social calendars. Some countries, including the UK, are already experimenting with immunity passports, which essentially mark those who are protected from COVID-19 infection and allow them to live and travel freely. On their face, such systems make sense, but Nicholas Evans, an assistant philosophy professor at the University of Massachusetts Lowell, says they are a slippery slope. An immunity passport constitutes a regulation on someone's freedom of movement or freedom of association, he says. Beyond that, immunity passports are not always productive, he says. Requiring such proof to travel internationally could encourage people to game the vaccine prioritization system, or more dangerously, try to get sick to gain natural immunity. A better solution, many experts believe, is investing in the public health infrastructure that went neglected before the COVID-19 pandemic, thus improving our ability to contain, respond to, and monitor coronaviruses and other pathogens. We need to invest in creating a healthier country, so when there's another virus, we will not be as unprepared as we were for this one, Galea says. In COVID-specific terms, that could mean funding a network of free testing centers around the country so experts can pick up on and respond to case clusters and new variants early. It could mean ramping up the U.S. biodefense program so that it's able to respond more nimbly to emerging pathogens. It could mean streamlining the vaccine production and distribution pipeline so people are able to easily get not only their first round of COVID-19 vaccinations, but also any boosters that become necessary in the future. As part of a proposed $1.9 trillion relief bill, the Biden administration has already asked for $50 billion in funding for testing and $20 billion for improved vaccine distribution. President Joe Biden in January also issued an executive order to establish a COVID-19 response coordinator and help prepare the U.S. for future biological and pandemic threats. Recovering from the pandemic must also involve better science communication to improve understanding of what must be done to curtail disease spread and to persuade Americans to actually do it. Elected officials, scientists, and public health experts must continue pushing out clear, trustworthy guidance that will help people tailor their behavior moving forward. If U.S. leaders communicate the best science-backed information available and transparently explain why certain precautions are required, that could go a long way. Stephen Taylor, author of The Psychology of Pandemics, says, whenever the U.S. emerges from the pandemic, normal may not look like it did in 2019. But if we heed the lessons the pandemic has taught, it could set us up for a healthier world moving forward. Jamie Ducharme wrote that article with reporting by Alice Park of New York. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. The number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.